Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Thursday, October 27th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by religions reporter Judah Ari Gross and environmental correspondent Sue Sirks. Hello to you both.
Morning.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. So let's get started with today's topics. We have Israel diaspora ties in the upcoming elections, Israel's plans for COP27, the United Nations Climate Change Conference that will take place in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And we have Chabad's woes in Russia, as well as green taxonomy. Judah, as we look toward next week's elections, you wrote about a panel that took place last week in which Israel diaspora ties were very specifically spoken about and discussed. What are the different candidates thinking about in terms of that relationship in the upcoming elections?
Israeli officials sort of across the political spectrum will say that Israel diaspora ties and the relationship, especially with American Jewry, is a national security asset, you know, and is of the highest importance. Generally speaking, that's not the thing that's driving Israelis to the polls. So mostly this election has been focusing on cost of living, on Israeli-Palestinian issues, on religion and state issues. But last week, the Reut Group think tank brought together candidates from seven different political parties. There were supposed to be eight, but the Likud dropped out at the last minute to discuss the issue of Israel's relationship with the diaspora, sort of where things stand now, what their vision is for the future. And a lot of it fell on pretty clear party lines. There was Yesh Atid and Labor were much more focused on improving Israel's relationship with non-Orthodox Jews. You know, currently the state of Israel sort of only officially recognizes Orthodox Judaism, which is always a sticking point with especially American Jews, the majority of which are not, you know, the vast majority of which are not Orthodox, are members of the Reform and conservative movements or are sort of unaffiliated in some way. And so Yesh Atid and Labor were much more focused on sort of improving those ties, sorting out the issues of the Western Wall. Meretz went a little bit more political with it and said basically that American Jews tend to be more liberal and that in order to improve the ties between Israel and American Jewry, Israel should make its policies and its politics be sort of more in line with that, specifically implementing the two-state solution, getting Israel, you know, Israelis out of the West Bank, things like that. She drew a lot of flack from that, from the right-wing candidates who are there, which is not particularly surprising, as well as from Yesh Atid, which sort of sees itself as centrist. And in terms of the right wing, the representative from the Religious Zionist Party who is there, which is a pretty, you know, firmly Orthodox organization, was Ohad Tal, who until he joined the party, was the head of the sort of Religious Zionist B'nai Akiva youth movement. And because as the head of an international youth movement, Ohad Tal was sort of was regularly in contact with other sort of non-Orthodox youth movements and was very involved in those types of international Jewish organizations. He definitely presented a bit of a friendlier face of the Religious Zionist Party towards the diaspora. In terms of the Western Wall, he said every Jew should feel comfortable praying there. But at the same time, he was sort of called out on the fact that that's not necessarily representative of the rest of his party, or the heads of his party, who generally speaking are not in favor of egalitarian prayer at the Western Wall, who want to keep that site to be, you know, firmly in the hands of Orthodox rabbis, and even then a specific sort of Orthodox worldview. For a night, you know, diaspora affairs were sort of very much on the docket. The Labor Party, which was represented by Gilad Kariv, who's also a Reform rabbi, he said very clearly that some of these issues of religious pluralism is going to be, you know, if they become part of any, you know, depending on how the election shakes out, if they're going to be part of any coalition, that issues of religious pluralism, and advancing non-Orthodox Judaism status in Israel is going to be, you know, a critical part of their coalition agreements, which until now it hasn't really been. It's sort of been a secondary issue. And he said it's going to be sort of a critical matter going forward. If they do get in, that would certainly have some significant ramifications.
All right. So we'll have to wait and see who gets into office, right? That's how it goes. All right. Sue, COP27 begins on November 6th, closer to home this year. What are some of Israel's plans regarding this year's climate change conference?
Well, this is, of course, the UN's biggest climate bash in the year. It takes place from the 6th to the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh. There's going to be 200 leaders there. The president, President Herzog, will be there. It's not yet clear whether the prime minister's going. Obviously, November the 1st, Israeli elections. But there is going to be a big delegation from Israel, officials from lots and lots of ministries. There are two, there's an official delegation, which will have officials, as I say, from many, many ministries. There's also six ministers who've got, so far, got accreditation to go. There will be also representatives of science and business and academia, youth groups, industry, obviously. And then separately, there will be a very large group running into the hundreds of NGOs, people from the non-profit sector. The COP events are divided into basically two zones, a blue zone, which is for official accredited people, fortunately, including the media, and the green zone, which is for the general public and where NGOs organise all sorts of activities. The green zone is usually much more fun. The thing about COP this year is that Israel, for the first time ever at a COP, is going to have an official pavilion, which looks very nice. It will have a film on a loop talking about Israel's climate tech. It will have 10 little stations. They're calling it the Boulevard of Climate Tech or something like that, featuring 10 climate tech companies that cover the gamut of subjects. There was a competition to select them, and their names were chosen, I think it was last month. There will be nearly 40 events at that pavilion, all sorts of different events. There's also a little auditorium with 45 seats. All the events will be live streamed as well. The aim, basically, the message of Israel is to say, climate tech is where we can really contribute to the world, where we can really make a difference, and also to reach out and say we are very interested in regional cooperation. So there'll be a lot of bilateral meetings at the pavilion as well. In addition to that, a lot of other Israeli events elsewhere in the blue zone and presumably the green zone. There's no timetable yet. Israel is turning out big this year at COP, bearing in mind that the emphasis this year at COP is going to be very much on the developing world. So a lot of the climate tech will be aimed at the developing world. And also just to say that Friday is Israel's annual climate march. So turnout is at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art. Events start at 10, the march starts at 11:30. Really important to be there and to show that people care.
Okay, we'll note that. Thanks, Sue. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, Judah will talk to us a little bit about Chabad Lubavitch in Russia and what's happening there right now.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now, and you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza, genocide perpetrated by Hamas, no, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its 6th season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Israel will be going back to the voting booths on November 1st. It is final. Back to the voting booths.
Welcome to Paralyzed Nation. This is Israel's 5th election in less than 4 years. But what are these elections actually about?
The politics of deadlock.
A face-off between populist identitarian politics and the effort to preserve Israel as a liberal democracy.
Small shifts at the margins.
I don't think we're going to have a solution. We're heading towards another deadlock.
The rise and the mainstreaming of what we might politely call the far right.
A referendum on Netanyahu.
I'm Amanda Borsell-Dan. Join me and our Times of Israel political analysts,
Chaviv Retigur,
Jeremy Sharon,
Carrie Keller-Lynn,
Tal Schneider,
David Horowitz,
as we drill down on these hard-to-answer questions in this limited edition podcast series that is exclusively for our Times of Israel community. Just go to timesofisrael.com/paralyzed to join our community if you haven't already, and to access the exclusive podcast starting October 6th. Welcome to Paralyzed Nation.
Okay, so we're back. Judah, we also have pieces about one that just went up yesterday or last night, I believe, about Chabad Lubavitch, which was recently termed a supremacist cult by a top security official. What is the update on that? Because, of course, that is not the more recent history of Chabad Lubavitch in Russia.
The Chabad Lubavitch Hasidic sect is very prominent in the former Soviet Union, especially in Russia and Ukraine. Since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine in February, Chabad, which operates in both Ukraine and Russia, has found itself in a bit of a delicate situation. It's been unequivocally, against war. You know, it's said very, very clearly that it, being against bloodshed, that the war should end. But it's also very carefully not said that it's Russia's fault, that, Russia is doing something bad, just being very sort of anti-war without assigning blame to it specifically. And this has been a kind of attempt by Chabad to keep a bit of a low profile, to, reflect its stances in terms of, being opposed to the war and seeing Jews suffering in Ukraine as a result of the war, but also not sort of endangering itself with Russian officials by being too, overtly opposed to the conflict and blaming Russia for it. Until now, Chabad has sort of been able to carry on its activities as usual, kept things up. And then sort of bit of a bombshell on Tuesday night, Wednesday, this article was published by the Assistant Secretary of Russia's Security Council, a man by the name of Alexei Pavlov, who talked about the need to de-Satanize Ukraine, that Ukraine is home to these neo-pagan cults and hundreds of different cults. And one of the ones that he listed was Chabad Lubavitch, which he, described as being a supremacist organization and, this fringe thing. And obviously for, this type of rhetoric in terms of, de-Satanizing, denazifying Ukraine has been going on for a while. But, when you start bringing Chabad into it, that has some significant ramifications for the Chabad that's back in Russia, right, which represents, the vast majority of the rabbis and the institutions that are in Russia, including Russia's chief rabbi, Beryl Lazar, who is affiliated with, who is a Chabad rabbi, right, and who until now has been seen as, being very close to Vladimir Putin. So this somewhat sort of blindsided the organization. Lazar put out an open letter, condemning this this article that was written, calling it vulgar anti-Semitism, and also saying that it raises some serious concerns. The fact that it's coming from a top security official, this isn't some random fringe anti-Semite. This is somebody, in a position of power. And so that's definitely calling, raising some major questions in the Jewish community in Russia, which until now hasn't been on such firm grounds. Our listeners might recall from previous podcasts and previous articles about Russia's ongoing legal fight against the Jewish agency in Russia. Sort of the Jewish community in Russia has been on a bit of shaky ground since the start of the war, and even before it. There's been, a lot, tens of thousands of Russian Jews and sort of Russians who are eligible for Israeli citizenship because they have relatives who are Jewish. There's been a huge exodus, the tens of thousands of people who have been leaving, some of them going back, some of them staying in Israel. But this is something that's definitely adding to the level of tension for Jews in Russia currently.
Right. And of course, what will that really mean for the Chabad rabbis and for the Chabad community? But I imagine more specifically for the rabbis.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine there's going to be, The Chabad in Russia has established itself following the, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union since the, you know, early 90s. Chabad has really come in, set up these institutions, set up these communities, and really tried to bring back some of the Jewish religious life in Russia. I can't imagine they're going to abandon that quickly. But at the same time, if a lot of that community starts feeling threatened and starts making its way, you know, not necessarily only to Israel, but also to parts of Europe and so on, you know, you're going to see sort of a bit of a scale back in terms of, Jewish life in Russia again.
Yeah, I imagine so. Thanks, Judah. Okay, Sue, tell us about green taxonomy.
Many terms are being taken in the business world from nature and the environment. One of them is ecosystem. Everybody today talks about ecosystems. And another one is taxonomy, which was originally used as a term and is still used as a term to classify plants into different orders and different families and so forth. So taxonomy means categories. Emissions of gases like carbon dioxide are responsible for global warming. An agreement was reached by the nations in Paris in 2015 to keep global warming down to 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, compared with pre-industrial times. This means, according to the experts, that we should be cutting emissions by 45% by 2030. Easier said than done. Emissions are still going up. Where are the emissions coming from? Mainly from the businesses and the industries that produce or use fossil fuels, and of course, the financial companies that support them. And many of those are using our money. It's the pension funds, the savings schemes, and so on. Now, up to now, attempts to move the capital from things that harm the planet to things that will help the planet have been based on something called ESG, which most business people will have heard of. ESG stands for Environment, Social and Governance. It's a very loose tool that is supposed to encourage companies, both in the financial sector and in the non-financial sector, to basically to report on their risk of exposure to climate risk. What does that mean if you invest in something that's next to the sea? It might be swallowed up by rising sea levels, that sort of stuff. There's no standardized rules for ESG. It's come under a massive amount of criticism, particularly recently, as a tool for greenwashing. This is where the taxonomy comes in. As I say, taxonomy is categorization. The European Union is leading the world on clamping down, first of all, on greenwashing, and secondly, trying to basically force transparency. Because, you know, if I know how my pension fund is being invested, I might choose a pension fund. It's harder because, you know, you certainly in Israel, you can't choose where your pension money goes. It's the company that chooses how it's invested and where it's invested. But the idea is that the more the investor knows, the more that people like us know, the more control we have over where our money goes in terms of choosing, the more pressure we can bring to bear on the pension companies to invest in green and so far. So the EU actually has, first of all, it has a very strict reporting directive, which covers about 50,000 companies. It's obligatory. It's anchored in law. Which says what they have to report. But they also have a green taxonomy, which is an extremely detailed list of what activities can be described as green. It's like a dictionary that underpins the reporting that they are obliged to make. Now, yesterday, Israel announced its first green taxonomy. Israel is following the EU, which I think is a very good sign because the EU really is the best that there is today. The Israeli taxonomy is being put out for public consultation. It will initially be voluntary. So the green taxonomy explains what are green activities. It will eventually lead to a green labeling system also for financial products. The next step will be to develop a red taxonomy, which shows which things are bad. And that will really help companies to strategize on their risk and what kind of direction to take. So it's a really important step.
Okay. I imagine we'll be hearing more about this, Sue, but thanks for the initial explanation. We'll look forward to that. Thank you, Judah. And thank you, Sue, for being on today's Daily Briefing.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
We'll be back Sunday with another week of Daily Briefings. In the meantime, tomorrow, Friday, brings us Times Will Tell, my interview with Lena Glickson, a Russian-born music editor in Hollywood who worked on season 4 of Stranger Things. So have a listen to that. We thank you for listening. Have a good day and see you again on Sunday.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.
Shalom.